Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the 50th anniversary of Pennsylvania's Environmental Rights Amendment to the state constitution. But up front, it's been a bloody week in Israel, but especially in Gaza. Missile attacks on Israel that started with small protests and escalated have led to retaliation by Israel. And now the two sides are close to all-out war. The conflict may have been a surprise to those not following the Middle East closely. There also are questions like, how did the violence start? Where did Hamas get the missiles they're firing into Israel? What, and if anything, can the United States do in response? To offer insights on our program today is Dr. Chris Bolin. He's a professor of Middle East Security Studies with the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Bolin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's a pleasure to join you, although I wish we had a happier topic to discuss.
Absolutely. If you have a question or comment or you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Bolin, as I said, this came as a surprise to many who weren't following the situation closely. What started this? This seems to have kind of a small start or a small protest, some things that were being protested. What started this that has almost led to all-out war?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a really complex issue with a long, long history, right? And it's basically the historical roots of this. I mean, this is a struggle between Jews and Arabs over who gets to establish a national homeland in Palestine. And effectively, you know, this violence just erupts because of an inability to reconcile these two claims. Now, and we can go into more detail, of course, in that later on, if you'd like. But really, the immediate spark was Palestinian demonstrations against the anticipated eviction of Arab families living in East Jerusalem. In particular, this is a neighborhood known as Sheikh Jarrah. The Palestinian families had bought their land and built their homes in 1948 in this neighborhood after they were expelled from other parts of the country. But recently, a U.S.-backed Jewish settler organization has been disputing those claims and who owns the land. And a decision from the Israeli Supreme Court was really expected soon. So these protests actually were certainly centered in that neighborhood in East Jerusalem, but they ended up spreading out through Arab communities in Israel and throughout the West Bank and Gaza as well. So on top of this, you had these heightened protests really occurring during an emotionally charged time. It's the holy month of Ramadan. Muslims typically gather in large numbers for prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which is Islam's third most holy site. And you had a growing Israeli police presence. You had restrictions being imposed on the ability of Muslims to gather during Ramadan. And all this really erupted after Friday prayers on May 7th, Palestinian protesters were throwing rocks at Israeli security. Israeli security really had a heavy-handed response with stun grenades. They were firing rubber-coated bullets. If you were watching Arab and Palestinian media, you know, you just saw Muslims in prayer, really fleeing prayer rooms. And bottom line is Hamas took advantage of this opportunity to really burnish its image as a defender of Muslim rights in Jerusalem. It launched thousands of rockets targeting civilian populations in and around Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and elsewhere. And we now see the heaviest fighting between Israel and Gaza that we've seen since 2014.
Yeah, when I say that these were minor protests. You know, what protest when in this region of the world is actually minor, because there has been a history of the violence escalating quickly. But when you talked about the mosque, I mean, one of the factors that led to the stone throwing and then the Israeli response to it was microphones or speakers being cut off during prayers. And the Islamic response to that, you know, the Muslims who were praying during Ramadan, responding to that. And as you said, the Israeli police had a heavy-handed response to it. So something like that could even just be the spark to start this violence. But one of the big questions is, how did it escalate so quickly? I mean, we're talking over the last 10 days with, you know, 3,100 rockets being fired into Israel, Israel targeting like 760 different places. How did this escalate so quickly?
Yeah, I think social media is part of the answer, right? I mean, and you're getting wildly disparaging, you know, views and interpretations of events depending on which media you watch. So certainly Arab Palestinian media, you know, was really highlighting that heavy-handed Israeli response. Of course, the Israeli media and U.S. media typically, you know, focuses more on the Hamas rocket attacks. I think that, you know, the Palestinians really, at least the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah, they had no interest in this expanding into an outright military confrontation between Hamas and Israel. I mean, that really only benefits Israel, because Israel obviously has, you know, a huge, tremendous conventional military superiority. So no one was certainly asking for this Hamas rocket barrage. But Palestinian leaders had actually recently canceled anticipated Palestinian elections, in which Hamas, I think, expected, and reasonably so, that they would probably fare pretty well in those elections at the expense of the Fatah ruling party in the West Bank. So, you know, this was an opportunity for them to kind of reassert their legitimacy, reassert their leadership, reassert their influence in internal Palestinian politics, and they took advantage of it, which is obviously incredibly unfortunate. But the, you know, Israeli response is widely anticipated, and you see this routine historical cycle of where Hamas, in an attempt to kind of reassert its role in the region, will launch rocket attacks. They fully know that there is going to be a heavy-handed Israeli retaliation, primarily through aerial and rocket artillery bombardments. They know that this is necessarily going to inflict pain on the Gazan civilian community, but they do it just to reassert their role and influence. And it's just an absolute, you know, tragedy by any step of the imagination.
I said that this came as a surprise to many Americans and maybe some other places around the world. But should it been? Should it have been? I mean, you follow this region closely. Should it have been a surprise that you know, this in this last week and a half that started the way it started and has escalated to the point it is?
No, not a tremendous surprise. I mean, I think events like this, of course, they're always, to a certain extent, unpredictable. You never know what exactly is going to be the specific spark to light this tinderbox. But observers of the region certainly knew that, you know, this was, intentions were increasing, and there was an increasing prospect of this escalating out of control if there was that spark. At least according to open source reporting and what you see, there were a number of Arab officials that were really phoning into Washington, just begging for U.S. intervention, calls to Netanyahu to kind of calm the temperature because of the risk that something like this could get out of control. Those kind of largely went unheeded until the very last minute. It was frankly too late. I mean, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and again, I think this was probably a question of too little, too late, knew that there were Jerusalem Day protest planned on, like, I think May 9th or 10th, and that typically they take a very controversial route through the Damascus Gate and Arab Muslim communities in an attempt to provoke a reaction, right? He knew that, and his authorities actually denied permission for that route to go through those sensitive communities in an attempt to kind of prevent this from escalating, but it was just too little too late. And again, Hamas just took this to a level that's detrimental to everybody concerned. Certainly doesn't serve Israeli citizens, and you see horrific pictures and videos of Israeli citizens cowering, in bomb shelters as the sirens alert them to incoming rocket attacks. So it's really just sad. The timing, I think, is just always unpredictable in terms of the particular uprising. We saw this with the Arab uprisings in 2010, right? You knew that there was this tension and dissatisfaction with Arab governments in the region, but it was what provided the spark was a Tunisian fruit seller vendor who, self-immolated, set himself on fire. And that, with modern media, that protest just spread throughout the region. And we saw Arab protests just spread everywhere throughout the region with no notice. Academics knew that this was a tinderbox, but predicting that particular spark is just always impossible.
President Netanyahu has had his political problems here, and maybe not just political, but even criminal, here in the past year or so. He's been charged with corruption. There could be cynics who have said that, one of the reasons that Israel has responded in the way it is that Israelis would come to his side with this kind of response. Do politics enter into this at all, do you think?
Well, they absolutely enter into it. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, certainly, and there are two kind of major schools of thought on this. There is one school, as you've kind of highlighted, that, look, he's under indictment. The court proceedings actually have started in terms of his indictment on corruption charges. And they're obviously delayed right now because of this ongoing conflict. So there is a school of thought that perhaps he at least willingly created increased tensions to provide him an ability to kind of bolster his, national security credentials. But there's also the reality that he's been unable to form a coalition government effectively in four elections over the past 2 years. So as a result of this, you have relatively inexperienced and, folks would argue, incompetent leaders too, that have been put into positions that just exacerbate this. And a lot of folks think that the relatively inexperienced positions in terms of the police chief in Jerusalem, in terms of the Ministry of Interior, perhaps kind of allowed this heavy-handed Israeli police response to developments of events in Al-Aqsa Mosque. So perhaps that kind of contributed. So it's this combination of the classic rally around the flag effect, where political leaders seek confrontation outside the country to deflect from tensions or weakness inside the country, and just the fact that it may well be an experienced leadership at the helm right now in Israel that's contributing to the mismanagement of this conflict escalation.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we'll be talking about vaccinating children against the coronavirus. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Chris Boland, professor of Middle East Security Studies with Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Boland, just before the break, you said that the Israeli response has been mismanaged. In what ways have it been mismanaged?
Well, I think just a failure to recognize how sensitive things were at Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, most folks know that this is one of the most sensitive areas in the world, right? In terms of who has access to it, you have it's obviously the site of three religious sites for three monotheistic religions in very, very close proximity. You have the Temple Mount, that's the most sacred site for Jews. Right on top of that, physically, is the Dome of the Rock, or the protective sanctuary for the Islamic sites that are literally right above that. And in close proximity, you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for the Christians. So these are always very sensitive issues in terms of who has access, under what conditions, and when. And when those traditional rules and regulations are pushed or totally ignored, that just leads to a very emotional response that is very likely to get quickly out of control. So I think, as you mentioned, you had Israeli police moving into the mosque, cutting access to the speakers during the holy month of Ramadan. You had a physical police presence on the Temple Mount, inside the mosque, and Israeli police using stun guns, smoke grenades, and rubber bullets, just scattering worshippers throughout the compound. So those are just going to provoke an emotional response. And I think more steadied, experienced hands would have recognized that restraint would have been the more preferred opportunity, right? That would have been the preferred course of action, is exercising restraint, not exacerbating these tensions during a particular sensitive time.
3,100 rockets launched into Israel. Many people are wondering how the Palestinians got those rockets. I mean, how did they pay for them? I mean, there have been reports that U.S. aid to the Palestinians helped pay for those rockets. I guess this comes back to the surprise element, that many were surprised that the Palestinians had access to this many weapons. Where did those rockets come from?
Well, they do. I mean, you rightly say, I mean, Hamas is a terrorist organization, right? Number one, first and foremost. It did win elections in 2005, so it, has some political legitimacy, but it exercises authoritarian control over Gaza. And so in terms of any kind of U.S. or international financial assistance, yes, certainly they are skimming money and resources off the top of that to bolster their own control. They're certainly diverting that from, what could be used better to improve the economy, improve the humanitarian conditions in Gaza, which are just deplorable. And they're assisted by groups and countries like Iran as well. I mean, even though Hamas is an extremist Sunni organization, Iran is a Shia power. They nonetheless, Iran offers financial and military support to Hamas, which is where they get their rockets, missiles, and technology to actually produce them on their own as well. So, observers of the region have long known that this was a capability that Hamas possesses, and really, not to paint even a more dire picture, but the situation is much worse on the northern frontier of Israel, where they confront Hezbollah, which is an organization that really enjoys even more open and direct support from Iran, and has any estimates of about 130,000 missiles that they can start raining down on northern Israel if they choose to do so. So that's one of the big worries of this Gaza-Israeli confrontation, is that this could also spill over to the north and could trigger a wider regional war. I don't think folks have an interest in that. But again, just as developments here around Sheikh Jarrah show, I mean, you can have just unintended escalation that happens even if political leaders in the region have no interest in doing so. These sparks can ignite a fire that end up being uncontrollable at the worst end, or cause incentives for escalation on the even more moderate end. So this is really a concerning situation.
Let's take a phone call from Robert in Fayetteville. Robert, you're on Smart Talk.
Well, thank you very much. I was just pondering the problems, the endless problems that we have trying to figure out Israel as a solution. And I was happy that you alluded to the historical roots of the cause. But is it a time for us? This seems almost like a George Floyd moment for Israel, where they have got to face the realities of their Arab population, and the country has got to face how it's going to be. Is the unthinkable thinking beyond this? I mean, the one-state solution, we talk forever about a two-state solution, and your interviewer, Scott, is wonderful, knowledgeable, but it's perplexing to me why we don't ever get beyond this terrible point. And political leadership is, of course, the issue, but how do we go beyond it?
Robert, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Bolin, this is a question that has been asked for a long, long time, but, you know, Robert's asking, what's the long term here? Is there a long term solution?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really open to question. That's a really perceptive problem. But really, one of the most disturbing aspects of this most recent confrontation is that it's not only Israel, Gaza, and Hamas. That's kind of the tried and true formula. We've seen where these escalations have gone in the past. So leaders know how to handle that. What's really disturbing is that there's been an increased intercommunal violence inside Israel, between Jewish Israeli citizens and Arab Israeli citizens. And these Arab Israeli citizens, I mean, have historically really, they consider themselves Israeli citizens, right? But you have just mobs of young Jewish extremists and Arab extremists now, you know, roaming towns that are occupied by both Arabs and Jews, have enjoyed, you know, decent relationships for decades, but those are fracturing. And you see just mobs attacking places of worship. They're burning shops, they're ransacking homes, they're stoning and beating fellow citizens without provocation. So this is really disturbing, and it really is tearing at the basic fabric of what, you know, Israeli democratic society would be. So it's a phenomenal concern, and it's a really disturbing new aspect of this latest round of confrontation. In terms of a solution, I mean, there's a big debate, right? You have analysts on one side saying, look, this violence just shows that a two-state solution is the only solution, right? If you had a one-state solution where you formally recognized a single state that exercise sovereignty all the way from Mediterranean in the west to the Jordan River in the east, you know, involved both. Essentially, it would be an equal split of about 5 million Arab Palestinians and maybe 7 million Israeli Jews. So it'd be kind of an even split demographically. But it just shows that this intercommunal violence would be a permanent feature of a one-state solution. At the same time, the reality of Israeli control over the West Bank, physical control over the West Bank, 400,000 Jewish Israeli settlers in the West Bank, just provides a patchwork of small, divided Palestinian communities. And there's really no hope that a Palestinian Authority under those conditions could exercise any meaningful control or sovereignty. So, you know, folks will say, look, the reality of Israel's control over the West Bank right now means that a two-state solution really isn't viable. So this is an inflection point, unfortunately, which way to go forward. You've got terrible alternatives on both sides, and you do not have political leaders on either the Israeli side or the Palestinian side who are willing to make the compromises and take the necessary risks that you would need to take to choose a path of peaceful coexistence for both. So it's really unfortunate. I just don't see an end to it. I think this is something that won't be solved. It'll have to be managed. And the U.S. will have to play a role. I mean, I think this is one of the lessons you've learned, is that a hands-off approach by the United States can only lead, but will probably lead to worse outcomes, because political leaders, either Israeli or Palestinian, just don't have the willingness or ability to take the steps they need to right now.
Let's take a call from Susan in Cornwall. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, I just had, I wanted to get your opinion on this. I was wondering about the moving of Jerusalem and basically giving it to the Jews, and where it was kind of a shared city at one point. And I think that was done under Trump. And also, I understand there was aid given to the Palestinians before Trump went into office, which helped keep basically their economy going and keep some of the young people in jobs and maybe away from Hamas. If I have wrong facts, I would appreciate your telling me. I would appreciate any comment you have on
that. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for your call. Dr. Bolin, moving moving United States to mission to Jerusalem. Any factor in this?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, this was part of the things. The Trump administration took several steps that were put them very much in the pro-Israel camp in terms of this Israeli-Palestinian dispute, right? And one of those, and one of the most important emotional symbolic decisions, was to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And unfortunately, there wasn't a countervailing step to perhaps recognize even a Palestinian consulate in East Jerusalem. I mean, that would have provided some balance to that equation, but unfortunately that option was not exercised. So this is part of the mounting Palestinian frustration, is they see the prospects for an independent Palestinian state just being frittered away by the day. They saw a U.S. administration that was essentially abandoning them, and as your caller, Susan, rightly points out, actually suspended U.S. aid to Palestinians altogether, suspended diplomatic contact with the Palestinians and their consulate here in Washington, D.C. So all the signs were that the U.S. was going to abandon the Palestinian cause, and that this was actually exacerbated by the Abraham Accords as well, unfortunately. I mean, overall, a positive step in terms of Arab countries formally normalizing relationships with Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. But unfortunately, this signaled to the Palestinians that even Arab states were no longer willing to back the Palestinian cause. So this is just, again, really kind of created a sense of hopelessness and despair on the Palestinian side, and kind of making the case among some extremist groups, right, that peaceful accommodation is not the way forward. Since Oslo, 1993, we've tried peaceful accommodation with Israel. We don't have an independent Palestinian state. Prospects are diminishing by the day. So guess what? Violence is your only option. And unfortunately, that's the case extremist groups like Hamas are making today.
That's Chris Bolin. I'd like to say that we are leaving you on a more optimistic note, but who knows where this goes. Chris Bolin is professor of Middle East Security Studies with the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Bolin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Enjoyed the conversation.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania is one of only a few states to recognize environmental quality as a basic constitutional right. 50 years ago, then State Representative Franklin Curry wanted to guarantee Pennsylvanians the right to clean air and water. and the Pennsylvania Environmental Rights Amendment was born and became part of the state's constitution. Former state representative and then state senator Franklin Curry says the global threat of climate change should make an amendment to the U.S. Constitution essential. In his new book, The Constitutional Right to Save the Planet, the People's Right to a Healthy Environment. Senator Franklin Curry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. I'm delighted to be back.
And I just wanted to mention that you could join WITF, State Impact Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania Parks and Forest Foundation for a free virtual documentary screening and panel discussion in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the state's Environmental Rights Amendment tomorrow, May 18th, at 7 p.m. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. 1-800-729-7532. All right, so before we get started on a little bit of the history of the amendment, Senator, I want to read it to our listeners. This is Article 1. Section 27, the people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. Pennsylvania's public natural resources are the common property of all the people, including generations yet to come. As trustee of these resources, the Commonwealth shall conserve and maintain them for the benefit of all people. So you were elected to the State House with cleaning up the Susquehanna River and waterways as one of your priorities. Before we get to how the Environmental Rights Amendment came to be, describe the environment when you were elected in the mid-60s.
Well, when I was elected in the mid-60s, I ran in 1966 on a Clean Streams platform. The incumbent representative, the senior Republican in the House, is one of six who voted against bringing the coal companies under the Clean Streams Act. And let me point out that since 1905, we had four amendments or four Clean Streams laws, and everyone gave an exclusion or special treatment to the coal companies. So in 1965, there was a bill, House Bill 585, to bring the coal companies under the Clean Streams Act once and for all. And that passed and became law, but the incumbent voted against it, and Bessie Beck, who was then a very outspoken advocate of the river belonging to all the people, got so mad he said, you run, Franklin, and I'll be your campaign chairman. So we ran, and the whole idea was that we would do something about a Clean Streams law. Because at that time, the people of Pennsylvania were just waking up to the fact that for a century, the environmental resources of our state had been brazenly exploited by the coal companies, the steel companies, and the railroad companies. So that was the natural environment when I got there. There were lots of mine drainage, lots of waste banks along in the coal regions, coal banks, lots of sewage in the water. It was a bad scene, but that was the whole idea of the legislature in the next few years was to try to reverse that.
Okay, so how then did the Environmental Rights Amendment come to be?
Well, it came to be because I was in the, since I've been elected to the House, I was put on the House Conservation Committee, which is a committee that considered all the legislation involving the environment. The committee was chaired by John LaDonia, who was also the president of the State Federation of Sportsmen. And I became the secretary of the committee. That's not a secretarial job. It's just a title you get. But it put me in the middle of the committee. And all of these bills, we passed in those four or five years, we passed more bills dealing with the environment than the entire history of the state put together. Clean Streams Bill, Clean Air Bill, Mine Bill, Strip Mining Bills, Waste Disposal, a whole bunch of bills like that. And I began to realize, well, wait a second. These bills are great, but they can be repealed or modified as quickly as they're passed. And then one day I was reading the New York Times, and I saw that there was an amendment to the New York Constitution that would amend the state's environmental law to protect state forests further. And it hit me. Why does New York have a constitutional amendment on the environment and we don't? So then I began to think about it. With all these bills going through, I thought we needed something more permanent. So I went back to my law school days. I had a pretty good course in constitutional law at Penn Law School. I also studied trust law. So I put the language together, and in the spring of 1969, I introduced the bill. And it went through the House and the Senate with four amendments. And it came back to the House in April 14th, 1970, which was the first Earth Day in the State House of Representatives. The Speaker of the House, Herb Feinman, had arranged to make that whole day on the environment. And I got to move that the amendments to my bill be accepted so we could put the bill on the calendar a couple of years, the next year after the next session. We also heard a speech from Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. So that's how we approved it in the House. The next year, I reintroduced it in January. It was passed in February, and it was on the ballot May the 18th, 1971.
So it was primary election day on May 18th, you know, primary election day tomorrow on May 18th. So primary election day on May 18th in 1971 as well. You know, one of the things that really struck me, Senator, was how this was. I mean, today, whenever we're talking about the environment or any kind of legislation having to do with the environment, and especially climate change, and we'll be talking about that in a few minutes, there's a great divide. Not when you introduced this legislation in the late 60s. I mean, both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, this legislation passed almost unanimously.
It did pass unanimously. There wasn't a single vote against it in either House and either session. Now, it was closely looked at. I said they put four amendments into it, so they didn't just blindly pass it. But you're right. In those days, we never heard of climate change. It was not a factor. Our amendment, was aimed at a reaction to the century of exploitation by steel, coal, and rails. So that we want to make sure that never happened again, but we never heard of fracking. We never heard of climate change. So that didn't come along till later. But now, as you point out, things have changed. And by the way, in those days, everything, as you say, was bipartisan. When I moved to accept the Senate amendments to my bill, the Republican leader of the Conservation Committee, Bill Wilt, seconded the motion. So we got along fine. We passed it. But now things are different. Climate change, you get the whole question of who believes in science and who doesn't. So it's a different world. But the principles of the amendment are still valid. I still think they're the right basis for trying to stop climate change or helping to stop climate change.
But just to go back to the state's environmental rights amendment for a moment, that decision, I should say that the amendment was seen by many as aspirational, something to aspire to, that the courts didn't see it as something that was in plain English. That changed in 2013 with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision, and subsequent decisions provided even more clarity, so that it is something that courts follow now. But I do want to move on to what you're proposing for the U.S. Constitution. The environmental challenges, as you said, have even greater consequences today with climate change and global warming. In your book, you're proposing a 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would provide all Americans with environmental rights. Why is it needed?
It's needed because the government is not facing the obligation it properly has to be the protector of the environment. And let me just say, it goes back to the original Constitution of 1787. It was absolutely silent on the natural environment. It was also silent on women's political rights. It was silent on slavery. Now, since that time, the slavery issues at least have been resolved by constitutional provisions. women's political rights were resolved by a constitutional amendment in 1919, but they're still silent on the natural resources and the environment. Now, here's the way I look at it. I think that the right to a decent environment, which is pretty much what the first sentence of the amendment of the Article 1, Section 27 provides, is a fundamental human right. It's as fundamental as the right to go to church of your choice, the right to free speech, and so right to free press, and so on. And I say, if those things are great, and they are, what good are they if we're going to suffocate in a few years with climate change? If the government can't protect us on the climate, what good is the government? I don't mean it quite as starkly as it sounds, but it ought to be a fundamental obligation of government. And the whole idea of Article 1, Section 27 is to place that responsibility on the federal government.
Well, let me read what you are proposing, the 28th Amendment, and it would read like this. The right to a healthy, stable environment. Trusteeship responsibility of the government for natural resources and future generations. The people of the United States have a right to clean air, a stable climate, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. The public natural resources of the United States, including the atmosphere, are the common property of all the people, including generations to come. As trustee of those resources or these resources, the government of the United States shall conserve and maintain them for the benefit of all people. It sounds very much like Pennsylvania's environmental rights amendment, but talk about the wording of that amendment. How did you come up with that?
Well, the new words, we put some new words in to make, I think the old Pennsylvania's version would cover it. But since the language, we changed the language because climate change is now here. It's hard on us. And we wanted to make sure that there was no question. That's why the atmosphere is specifically invited there as part of our natural resources. And God, if we don't have the right atmosphere, we're in deep trouble. And the same with the other language. It was all changed to make it clear that we really need a healthy environment.
You know, you said yourself that, you know, we can't get members of Congress to even agree that global warming exists. How could we possibly get this through Congress and, you know, that they would add a 28th Amendment, an amendment, by the way, the 27th Amendment was added years ago, decades ago now. How could you get something like this through Congress?
Well, and no question, it's going to be a tough uphill fight. To get a constitutional amendment through the U.S. Congress, it has to pass both houses by a two-thirds majority in each house. And then it's got to go and be approved by 34 or three-quarters of the state legislatures. So it may be impossible, but I don't think so. I never forget, I was talking to Kathleen Pavelko, who our listeners know well. She said, well, if it's so difficult, why is it worth the try? And I said, it's worth a try because if you don't do anything, nothing will happen. If you do something, something may happen. And I think there are more and more people in Washington who are waking up to the fact that we have to deal with science, just like we did with the COVID-19. You got to deal with the science here. We have to really move on it. So, and I also think you're going to see more and more, maybe more dire changes in the climate. I mean, it was Saturday's New York Times had a front page story. Climate change worse than ever, EPA says. So it's getting worse, and I think if people realize it, they'll be more inclined to do something like I'm advocating. So I think we got to make the fight and see what happens. The worst we can do is not make it, but we can't sit by idle, in my opinion.
You know, one of the things that's different, though, Senator, is that when you came up with Pennsylvania's Environmental Rights Amendment when it was voted on in 1971, it was, you know, the damage to the environment was very easy to see. I mean, there was that famous picture of you holding up a jar with clean water from tap and then black water that was taken out of the Shamokin Creek, I believe. Very, very easy to see. With climate change, it happens over time, and it's not as easy to see and say, oh, this is what's happening. For those who you know, go with the science, believe in the science, they can see it. But for others who say, what's happening? You know, this is a natural cycle, you know, for those who deny it exists. That would seem to be a challenge here, that not right in front of me kind of thing would make it more difficult for some members of Congress who also say that it will put the United States economy at, it's some kind of, it will be a challenge for the economy. That's one of the reasons that it would be difficult to pass. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you. In fact, I have in my book, Chapter 11, it specifically talks about this point, that I couldn't hold up two jars of air like it was two jars of water, clean and dirty, because they all looked pretty clean. So what I did, and I didn't want to just recite scientific results. So what I did in Chapter 11, I interviewed 4 or 5 people who are not scientists, but who on the ground see that what climate change is doing to the planet. My first interview was with Sean Norman, who's a district firefighter chief in District 13 of California. He's been on the front line of forest firefighting out there for a number of years. And he gave me a very good interview, which is in the book, about how climate change is causing forest fires out there. Then I went down to Will Baker at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, just south of us here. And he explained to me how climate change is affecting the Chesapeake Bay, and that's in the book. Then I talked to Scott Weidensall, who's a migratory bird expert, a Pennsylvania native, and he explained to me the same thing with regard to migratory birds. All these things just all fit together. It shows you what climate change is doing. We also got I didn't talk to them, but I got pretty good quotes from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States military, Mark Milley. The Army is convinced that climate change is a major threat to the national security because of what it does to our bases and so on. So I put all that in Chapter 11 to show that regardless of the way you think of science, here are 4 or 5 people on the ground who have seen it and they know what they're talking about, and they say we got to do something.
We have a question here from Michael, who says the environment is typically not afforded priority, usually due to perceived threats to the economy, despite that a healthy economy depends on a healthy environment. With the state's Environmental Protection Amendment, how is it that real estate developers and industries like natural gas are apparently exempt from long-term environmental impacts?
Well, I don't know if they were exempt. I mean, you say the natural gas industry, well, they weren't exempted. They are highly regulated, unlike the coal companies, which weren't regulated at all. The coal companies didn't have the right to put their waste into the streams untreated. Now, the law regulating fracking and natural gas is not perfect, but it is so much better than what to face the coal companies. And they do have to obey the state law. And different agencies, the Delaware River Basin Combat Commission, now outlawed fracking. I mean, they are subject to it. They're not exempt.
Mm-hmm. Senator, we only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much. I always enjoy talking to you. An amendment has been proposed before in Congress. It's never made it out of committee. In about 40 seconds, why do you think that there is a better chance that eventually there will be an amendment that would guarantee clean air, clean water, clean atmosphere to the U.S. Constitution?
Because the threat of climate change is going to force it upon us. It's coming very rapidly. It's here now. We've got a few years to act on it. Unlike the coal companies, which have done their damage, climate change is still taking place. It's still evolving. We've got to stop it. And I think it's getting more and more serious, and people will realize that. And I think that will eventually be reflected in our congressional delegations.
By the way, later this week, the state's climate report that says temperatures could rise 6 degrees in the next 30 years is something that we'll be looking at on Smart Talk. And Senator Curry tomorrow night with WITF, State Impact Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Parks and Forest Foundation, a free virtual documentary screen and panel discussion celebration of the 50th anniversary of the state's Environmental Rights Amendment. That's tomorrow at 7. Former state senator and Representative Franklin Curry, always good talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Delighted to do it and keep going. I appreciate what you do.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.